Today on the 21st, Illinois lawmakers ended a brief special session over the weekend, approving a state spending plan and other legislation. We'll have a recap. Then today, May 26th, would have been the 94th birthday of jazz legend and Illinois native Miles Davis.
Miles really helped stretch the definition of the word jazz to a different level of intellectual engagement.
I refer to it as Miles Davis University. You just had to be on your toes every night.
When he realized that you could go to Europe and get treated like an artist instead of just a black musician or a black man, it was a whole new experience.
I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Early Sunday morning, the Illinois General Assembly wrapped up a four-day legislative session. Wearing masks and keeping socially distant, they did so without the usual swarm of lobbyists and members of the public to bear witness. But two people who were there to bear witness are joining us this morning to recap the session. Rick Pearson is chief political reporter with the Chicago Tribune and host of The Sunday Spin, heard Sunday afternoons on WGN Radio in Chicago. Rick, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me this morning.
Brian, good to be with you.
And Hannah Meisel, who's Springfield reporter for The Daily Line, an online news source. Hannah, welcome back to the 21st.
Glad to be here.
So, Rick, I want to begin with you because you have covered a lot of sessions of the Illinois General Assembly. Have you ever seen anything like this with the masks and the, you know, renting out the convention center and things like that?
No. And, of course, obviously, these are strange times for all of us. And just to be clear, I was not in Springfield.
Sure.
I was kind of quarterbacking things. But, you know, of course, a lot of jokes being made about members of the political class showing their true colors by wearing masks. That having been said, I do think, despite the fact that the House met, you know, blocks away from the State House, the Senate meeting in its chambers, kind of that physical divide, the physical divide of the contact, and that's always kind of the glue that makes legislative sessions go, I think there was more of a sense of purpose in doing something among the legislators as a whole than what you normally see in a session that, you know, expands for multiple days. There's no kind of sense of urgency. There's never obviously been anything of this level to be addressed by a General Assembly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, against that backdrop, I just sensed a different attitude among lawmakers.
And Hannah, what about you? You were in Springfield for session. What was the mood like on the ground? Did you even run into other people, or were you mostly just keeping to yourself in the press room? What was it like?
You know, I didn't actually go into either the Capitol or the Convention Center. Yeah. I did visit outside the Convention Center one day to view the protesters who were present on the first day of session. But, you know, I think it was pretty tense in the beginning. You could see that. And throughout the 4 days, I think as people, you know, lawmakers and staff got a feel for how things were going, I think it became a little bit more relaxed, a little bit more back to normal when, of course, you know, nothing is normal about this, but at least you have, you know, the very weird, unique rhythm of session that helps people, you know, sit, like, we're here for this common purpose. We got to get out of here and get everything done. And they were able to accomplish that with only one unplanned day of session.
Yeah. So, all right, let's talk about some of the things that they were able to get done. And Hannah, let's start with the state budget. This is arguably the most important piece of legislation that the state passes every year. You know, what's the sort of thumbnail sketch of the Illinois budget for the next fiscal year, which begins on July 1st?
Right. So though we are, we've already lost a lot of revenue in this current fiscal year, which hasn't even ended yet, and we're projected to lose, you know, billions more next year. It's actually basically the same budget that we had last year, $40 some billion. It relies instead on of you know the expected revenues that we would have gotten in normal times. We're going to borrow $5 billion from the Federal Reserve and also count on you know another big congressional stimulus package down the line. When that's going to happen, no one is truly certain. Of course, Republicans are upset that the objective is to balance a budget, but you know the Constitution isn't necessarily specific on how you balance that budget, and so we're relying on a lot of federal help here. You know, there are a couple places here and there where the budget, funding was decreased from last year, but for the most part, it's maintenance. And then there are some areas of the budget like child welfare and human services that are getting boosts because, you know, after the pandemic is over, or at least as things begin to loosen up, there's a pretty prevalent belief among people who are in, you know, human services, child welfare sectors that there's going to be an explosion of need. Because you had families who are very, very stressed out, you know, basically at home altogether for weeks upon weeks. And though, for example, calls to the child welfare hotline for Department of Children and Family Services have been way down, there's actually a belief that child abuse and neglect is way up.
Mm-hmm. So briefly, before we move off the budget topic, this is always something that gets a headline every year. Are state lawmakers getting a raise this year? I recognize the answer might be a little complicated, but as simplified as you can you address that point?
It is complicated. So, legislators actually have an automatic cost of living increase. And for many years, they have actually voted to not give themselves, but they have to take that action to not give themselves the cost of living increase. Last year, for the first time in many years, they actually voted or didn't do that. And so they essentially got, that increase. And this year, they didn't actually, put the language in to cancel that out. However, they're arguing that there's an agreement with the comptroller to not pay it out and that there's not actually money appropriated. However, by not putting it in language, they've now created a huge brouhaha for themselves.
Yeah. And it seems like if somebody sues, I guess they can still, it seems like even though if the money's not there, they may have to, a judge could force the controller's hand. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Hannah Meisel, who's Springfield reporter for The Daily Line, and Rick Pearson, chief political reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Rick, the usual money in Springfield is against, I'm going to mix my metaphors here, but you usually bet against gambling expansion legislation. And we had a big step forward last year, but Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot wanted some change around that. And although there was a lot of doubt heading into this brief special session, she was able to pull it off. Can you talk a little bit about what Chicago got for their gambling, Rick?
Brian, I'm like you. I mean, when there was talk of trying to advance a critical item on Mayor Lightfoot's agenda by changing the tax structure for a Chicago casino, I kind of rolled my eyes and went, well, here comes the Christmas tree bill where everybody loads it up with everything and it falls over of its own weight. But it was a pretty miraculous passage of this legislation and in many respects bipartisan passage. Basically, I'm not going to go too far into the weeds because there's a lot of technical things, but I think the easiest way to sum it up is that after Chicago was authorized to have a casino, study was done, came back and basically said that you wouldn't find a developer based under the current tax structure that the legislature passed it. A lot of upfront kind of money required from a developer, a lot of early big money before the thing is kind of established, and those issues were relaxed. And so one of the things that I think was a leading factor in this moving through was the fact that lawmakers basically have made a Chicago casino, the state revenue portion of that, as a critical part of the $45 billion public works package that they had previously approved. And if the casino ain't moving, there's a lot of roads and bridges across the state that are going to be in a world of hurt. This gave downstate lawmakers something in exchange for voting something that could be perceived as, you know, pretty much Chicago. There were a couple of downstate elements in it, video gaming at the state fairs, but, you know, are we going to have a state fair?
Good question.
Springfield. There was some technical changes for a casino in Danville, but this was really a big win. And I should add, too, that everybody talks about pensions and the city's share of casino tax revenues are earmarked to shore up the city's police and fire pension.
Well, more to come from that. And I guess as there is hunger for jobs and this having state government spend on construction, that maybe explains a little bit about why people were willing to take that leap. Rick, I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that didn't happen, which was a vote on the governor's phased reopening plan. You know, the governor had this emergency rule that would have allowed for misdemeanor offenses for business owners who violate the stay-at-home orders. And I think we had heard calls for having the legislature weigh in on this reopening. What can you say about why that didn't happen?
I think one good reason is because, now this was something Republicans were pushing, was they wanted an up or down vote on the governor's phased-in reopening plan. I think there's a good reason here, and I think it's because it's not totally partisan here, is that there are a number of people on the Democratic side who aren't happy with the way things are going. Some of them siding with their local officials in Democratic areas, supporting an earlier reopening than the governor has proposed. The emergency rule that would have created that misdemeanor penalty for business owners that violated the stay-at-home order that was pulled from a legislative rulemaking committee, in part because there was the belief that even though it was a bipartisan panel, Democrats would join with Republicans to quash it. So I think this was more of a protective measure by letting, let the Republicans complain about it, but for Democrats, I think it was more a protective measure for the governor and not facing a vote that could be very embarrassing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. That's Rick Pearson. He's chief political reporter at the Chicago Tribune. We're also speaking with Hannah Meisel, Springfield reporter for The Daily Line. So, Hannah, talking about the governor's, you know, phased plan for reopening, by the end of the week, most of Illinois is set to move into phase three, the next phase of the governor's reopening plan. Can you give us just briefly, and we're coming to the end of our segment in a few minutes here, but what is a sort of thumbnail sketch of what people can expect as the state moves into this next phase?
Right. So the big news last week was that the governor changed his mind, or you could say caved to pressure from that restaurant industry, and restaurants will be and bars will be able to reopen for outdoor seating with tables 6 feet apart. Beyond that, businesses are still being encouraged to let people work from home, but some offices may open back up with, you know, a maximum amount of people allowed, 50% of capacity. You know, gyms will reopen with social distancing guidelines. Salons, you know, you can go get your nails done so long as you wear a face covering and, you know, the person giving you a manicure gives you a face covering. Youth sports can resume practices, but not games. And they'll have to socially distance. So, you know, tackle football will probably be out of the question, but maybe they can do drills. Driving ranges, shooting ranges will reopen. Youth camps, that's a big deal for working parents. They will be able to reopen with, capacity guidelines, social distancing guidelines.
Rick, does all that apply up in Chicago too? And I wonder if you're seeing up there people getting antsy with the restrictions. I was struck. I went to a garden center over the weekend, and I was struck by the number of people not wearing masks, whereas in previous trips to grocery stores and other essential shopping I've done, I was impressed that most people were wearing masks, but a lot of them seem to be kind of getting tired of that.
Yeah, and I think too, obviously with the weather change, and certainly, you know, yesterday was just such a glorious day, and it was almost kind of like you could see that people were almost kind of breaking out of hibernation kind
sure.
of thing. And there were Wrigleyville was swarmed with people. Other places were swarmed with people. I noticed too fewer people wearing masks. I just don't know if people just felt a certain liberation from the weather and what that means going forward. But Mayor Lightfoot, the municipalities are allowed to move more strictly than the governor's orders. So the lakefront's still closed. Some most city golf courses are closed. Restaurants are not going to be able to do that outdoor kind of situation of seating until the more strict guidelines are put into place. So it's going to be more of a phase in Chicago than it is probably elsewhere in the state.
The mayor apparently trying to call into the show right now. Yes, Hannah, it's all right. It's live radio. Hannah, last question to you. I just briefly, there's so much to talk about that we're not going to be able to get to, and we will, of course, link to yours and Rick's and his colleagues' stories on our Twitter page, which is 21ST Show. That's 21st Show. But one thing that didn't happen, Hannah, and again, just in about 30 seconds, if you can, is this idea of moving to virtual legislating. There was a lot of consternation when this legislation was debated on the floor. Can you briefly recount what might have been?
Yeah, you know, I was a little bit surprised by the debate, but it makes sense. So, for example, Tim Butler, the representative that represents here in Springfield, he was very offended by the notion that even, you know, while the pandemic still goes on, that they would even consider remote legislating. And, you know, because the Constitution says it should, you know, legislating should go on in the seat of government. You know, and then he also had people come to his defense saying it blocks out people being able to participate in the process. And then, of course, what we've all experienced during this pandemic, Zoom it's fine, but it's not ideal. Lots of technology snafus, things happen, and it's not as effective. And, you know, they said, you know, we were able to get things done because we were here in Springfield together.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Hannah Meisel is Springfield reporter for The Daily Line. We've also been speaking with Rick Pearson, chief political reporter at the Chicago Tribune. Hannah, Rick, thanks so much for spending your morning with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a conversation about Miles Davis, who would have turned 94 today. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. More to come. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening to So What, released by the legendary jazz musician and composer Miles Davis in 1959. It's from his album Kind of Blue, one of the best-selling jazz albums of all time. Today, May 26th, would have been the 94th birthday of Miles Davis, a man born and raised in Illinois who would grow up to change the course of music through his innovative, impromptu style. We're joined via Zoom by his son, Aaron Davis, and Vince Wilburn Jr., who's a nephew of Miles and also serves as band leader and drummer in the Miles Electric Band. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Hey.
Hey, thanks for having us, man.
All right, and if you listening out there have a favorite tune of Miles, we'd love to hear about it. Tweet us at 21st Show. Aaron, I want to start with you. Your father was born in Alton, Illinois, but grew up in East St. Louis. What did he tell you about his childhood? When and where did he find his love of music?
When did he discover his love of music? I think early on, you know. I think his parents wanted him to play music. His mom wanted him to play violin, right, V?
Mm-hmm.
And he said his dad overruled her. He got a trumpet.
Man, imagine how differently the world would be if he had taken up the violin instead of the trumpet. So eventually he goes to the Juilliard School in New York City. Aaron, I wonder, how did that time in his life help shape his music?
Well, I mean, in my opinion, that time in his life, you know, when he went to Juilliard, I mean, he really got into like some of the classical stuff. Because, you know, obviously they weren't teaching jazz back then. So he was just diving into all the charts and scores of all those great composers and like seeing what they're doing from the inside out. And then I think when he got what he wanted, he's like, well, all the stuff I really want to learn is down there with Diz and Bird. He was just getting more out of that. I mean, I watched something on YouTube last night where he was talking to Marcus Miller back in the 80s on Night Music, on David Sanborn's Night Music show. And he said he wanted to quit every night with those guys. But obviously he was getting so much out of that. You know what I mean? Like, well, what did he say, V, that he would, they'd play it ahead and leave him up there?
Yeah. Yeah. One of his first gigs with Bird was, they didn't have a trumpet player. Somebody couldn't make it. And so they said, well, Bird, who do you see, who's going to play trumpet tonight in your band? He pointed at Uncle Miles. And Uncle Miles was looking around like, who, me? It's in the documentary, too.
Yeah, yeah. And people aren't familiar. Bird is, of course, Charlie Parker, the great saxophonist, and Dizzy Gillespie. And I think that's half his education in New York, right? So he spends the days in Juilliard, but then at night he's playing with these jazz legends.
Yeah. Hanging out.
So from cool jazz to bebop to hard bop jazz, Miles, I think his compositions, his trumpet playing, and orchestral arrangements were legendary. And Vince, I wonder, what was it like to play music with your uncle?
I refer to it as Miles Davis University. You just had to be on your toes, you know, every night. I mean, even though we had a set list, but it would be variations in the set list every night, because what he did, he would listen to the concerts. He had board tapes, cassettes from the front of the house, the mixer. And he would critique and change things, and he'd have us come up to his room, and he'd add or take away things he heard in his head, and then we'd try it the next night. So that's how the tour developed, you know, and the songs would take shape and move around. And like, what did Lenny say? An amoeba, you know. But he had that knack for knowing, and he would know what the audience, how to shift the concert, shift the songs during the concerts, you know, cut them off, go to the next song. Put something else in, change the set list. It was amazing.
So there's a documentary, as you referred to a few minutes ago, called Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool. It debuted earlier this year, and you can still view it on the PBS Passport app. Let's take a listen to what Herbie Hancock said about working with Miles.
Miles wanted us to live on the stage in front of the people, creating in front of the people. In other words, don't lean on what you know. What he was looking for is the stuff that you don't know.
That was a clip from Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, a documentary that aired on PBS earlier this year. If you have a favorite tune of Miles, tweet us at 21st Show. You are listening to the 21st Show. We're talking with two men close to Miles Davis. May 26th would have been the Illinois native's 94th birthday. His son, Aaron Davis, and his nephew and bandleader, Vince Wilburn Jr., are joining us today. Vince, you were a drummer in his band. Do you have any distinct memories of crowd reaction to his playing?
Just when he would walk on stage, everybody would, you know, it was like you could hear it, you could feel it. And when you could really kind of vibe it from the first downbeat, the second song was a ballad, you know, it was a blues. So when you could hear the muted quietness of the audience, it was like they were in a trance. And he had a wireless, so everywhere on stage he would go on stage, you know, the audiences, the faces would shift and follow him, like the Pied Piper. It was like, it was amazing to see that Uncle Miles would have a spell, you know, so to speak, over the audience. You know, that was incredible. Then I remember one concert at Giant Stadium. It was a Amnesty Live Aid. I think it was about 70,000 people at Giant Stadium, and you know. It's like a sea of people at Giant Stadium, and Uncle Miles had everybody was focused on him. You know, it was just in numerous concerts, and Eric can attest to this.
Absolutely.
Everywhere, all over the world, he had that magic, that aura.
Miles Davis was not shy about talking about the Black experience in America and around the world. And we're going to listen to an excerpt from 60 Minutes about an exchange he had with a teacher at Juilliard when she tried to explain the connection between Blacks and blues music.
I told a student teacher of mine like that in Juilliard. She started talking about, the Black people would respond to the night and it just... And they say, that's where the blues came from. So I raised my hand. I said, listen, my father's French, my mom is good looking, right? And I can play the blues. I never suffered. and don't intend to suffer.
That was Miles Davis on 60 Minutes. In 1959, Davis was beaten by a New York police officer who accused him of loitering in front of the jazz club he was performing at the same night. Pictures of him in bloody clothes are on the internet, and in an interview with Dick Cavett in 1986, Davis talked about being stopped in his expensive cars weekly by police officers who thought he'd stolen them. Aaron, I wonder, despite your father being a world superstar, he still dealt with discrimination and racism. Can you talk about what toll that took on him? And I wonder, what do you think your father being so open about his experiences has to teach the world about the broader Black experience?
Well, I mean, I think he'd gone through more than enough of that kind of stuff, you know, when he was younger and even like when he was older sometimes. But, and I think when he realized that you could go to Europe and get treated like an artist instead of just a Black musician, you know, or a Black man, you know, it was a whole new experience. And once you get back to America and you have to go through this all again, I think that was probably the hardest part about it, is like realizing that there are people who see things differently, but they're just not here. They're not here, you know? And, you know, with me, we did talk about, he was always making sure that I was aware of what I should be doing, what I can expect from, the police at times and things like that.
You know, and I was interested in the documentary pretty early on. I think Quincy Jones talks about the evolution of the music we were talking about Bird, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Miles, that jazz was evolving in the way it was as sort of a reaction away and against the minstrelsy type music, and, you know, no smiling and laughing and no grinning, no dancing, no entertaining. That's what Quincy Jones said in the documentary. Can you talk about that? How that influenced the music, that sort of anti-reaction or reaction to what had come before?
You know, he really, really frowned on that minstrel type stuff, man. And, you know, that's probably, that's not something I had to grow up with. So I don't really, can't really speak on what that feels like, but, you know, just from the stuff I saw in the documentary, you know, that must have been rough. You know, you're trying to get your ideas across musically, and you're thinking on the same level as a Stravinsky or whoever you want to name, and you got to deal with this minstrel stuff, you know, and it's like, you know, you don't get taken as seriously that way. You know what I mean? It's just, I'm glad I didn't have to come up through that, man.
And Vince, in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, as jazz's popularity, at least as a sort of a mass popular form of music, is lessening, Miles Davis's innovation keeps going. And you're a band leader in the Miles Electric Band. When you're playing with them, can you talk about, how did he adapt as music fans turned to rock and disco and other forms of popular music?
Well, you got to figure the way his mind worked. He didn't want to, he was always evolving. So he wasn't going to play Stella by Starlight in 1970, you know, or Bye Bye Blackbird, you know. When the times changed, he changed, but he was ahead of the curve, you know. Always ahead of the curve, always thinking about advancing the music, you know, or if there was a ballad or he wanted his interpretation of human nature, his interpretation of time after time. Someday my prince will come, you know. I just use those three songs, but his mind was always pushing the music. So I think Herbie Hancock's first time he ever played an electric piano was with Uncle Miles. You know, he didn't know, you know, they never saw an electric piano before. But it's not surprising, because that's the way his mind worked. And he called his music social music. So he was trying to always change and always evolve and stay a step ahead of the curve. That was just Miles, you know. He didn't set out to be a rock musician. He didn't set out to be, you know, he wanted his music to reach as many people as possibly could. And that's what happened.
And Vince, what do you think Miles would think of today's music?
I don't know. What do you think? Because, you know, some things he would probably dig and some things he wouldn't, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be somebody that he's going to be like, oh, you got to hear this.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the vast majority of the stuff that's on the radio has been played for the last 40 years. So I don't think anything is – there's not going to be too much new stuff that he's going to be excited about on the radio. But there'll be somebody out there.
Sure.
Yeah.
Somebody doing something. I mean, I don't want to, like, start saying who I think he would like. But, I mean, I know that there's definitely some acts out there.
Hey, Aaron, tell a story about the drummer when you were looking at TV. And the drummer, you thought he was cool?
Oh.
I think that's cool.
I was watching, this is like back in the 80s, you know, I was watching MTV, and I think it was a Slayer video was on. And he came down, and I was like, oh, he's probably going to hate this. And he walked by, and he kind of looked at it for a second, and he said, damn, the drummer's really laying it down, huh? And he just walked away.
That's pretty cool.
Miles Davis and Slayer. I don't think people would have expected that.
No.
You know, he kept an open mind, you know?
Yeah. So we're coming to the end of our conversation here, just about a minute left. Aaron, I wonder, do you have a favorite work by your father?
Oh, well, I mean, it's funny you said that because, you know, it usually changes week by week or whatever. And this week it's been, we've been looking at a lot of his music, you know, looking at celebrating, you know, his birthday today. And for me today, my favorite track right now is called Savad from Live Evil. It's just, it's this amazing live track with Michael Henderson and on bass. And it is just killing.
And Vince, same question to you. What's your favorite work by your uncle and bandmate, Miles Davis?
Well, okay. So that's, you can't have a favorite. Well, three favorites.
All right.
We just received a plaque for Kind of Blue at 5 million now. So that's the largest jazz record of all times. So that's still a go-to. But like, I'm got to agree with my cousin, Agartha, you know, that was recorded in Japan with Michael and those guys. That's like, woof, you know. And then Seven Steps to Heaven, because I was talking to Ron Carter the other day and we were talking about that. So I have three that I rotate. Like meditation every morning, you know, and then I get on with my day. So sorry, I don't have one.
Fair enough.
That's my three go-tos.
Vince Wilburn Jr. is a nephew, drummer, and band leader of Miles Electric Band. We've also been talking with Aaron Davis, son of the legendary musician Miles Davis. We talk with them as we remember the Illinois native who would have turned 94 today. Thank you both for joining us here on the 21st.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
We also want to ask our listeners, what is your favorite Miles Davis song? Tweet us at 21st Show, just like our former intern Jasper Davidoff did with this, which is Miles Davis performing the Wayne Shorter piece Footprints off the 1967 album Miles Smiles. Up next, how you can see where Davis spent his childhood years right here in Illinois. And we'll talk to a music professor who tells us how young people are finding a connection to his music. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening to Milestones, a composition by Miles Davis. He's, of course, performing trumpet and is joined by other jazz greats, Cannonball Adderley on alto saxophone, John Coltrane on tenor saxophone. Davis was born May 26th, 1926, in Alton, Illinois. He grew up in East St. Louis. In our last segment, we talked with his son and nephew about his musical legacy. Now let's bring in two more perspectives. Joining us on the line now is Lauren Parks. She's president of the House of Miles in East St. Louis. She oversaw the renovation of Miles Davis's boyhood home, which has attracted people from around the world. Lauren, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
And we're also joined by Tammy Kernodle of Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. She teaches a course in classical and popular African-American music, jazz, and much more. She's got a PhD in music history from The Ohio State University. She appeared in the recently released documentary Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, which is still available on PBS Passport if you want to check it out. Dr. Kernodle, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to be here with you today.
And if you have a favorite tune of Miles Davis, tweet us. We'd love to hear about it. You can tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. Professor Kernodle, what ways would you say that Miles Davis music was transformative?
I think Miles really helped stretch the definition of the word jazz and shifted it beyond this kind of public consumer culture to a different level of intellectual engagement. You know, he was perhaps one of the most experimental, most creative voices to come out of this idiom that we signify as jazz, you know, constantly shifting and constantly willing to take creative chances that many of his peers were unable to take.
Lauren Parks, I'd like to bring you into the conversation now. If we were to drive up to 1701 Kansas Avenue in East St. Louis, I wonder, would we hear and see Miles Davis as soon as we pull up to the House of Miles?
Absolutely. The energy greets you as you pull up. And that's interesting that you say that, Brian, because we've been told that by numerous visitors. We had a young man and his family drive from Louisiana, and we did not know they were coming. And we just happened to be, we were working out in the yard, and he pulled up, got out of his family's car, and he began playing trumpet, the trumpet, right in front of the house. And his dad said, there was no way that we could take our vacation without stopping by and feeling the spirit of Miles Davis and not have my son play on the very site where Miles grew up. And so that was an incredible testament for us and how this project has motivated, has inspired, and has built this huge community nationally and internationally. And that is what keeps us going and keeps us moving. And we are just so honored to be a part of preserving such a rich, rich legacy and history of Miles Davis and the East St. Louis community.
What was East St. Louis like when a young Miles Davis was growing up there?
During the time where Miles grew up, East St. Louis was a very hustling and bustling industry town. There were a lot of businesses there in town, of course, including his father's dental practice, which was on 15th and Broadway, which was not far from 17th and Kansas, where he grew up. And so East St. Louis was a very thriving community. And East St. Louis is rebuilding, in the process of rebuilding, and that is what makes this project inspiring to be a part of the resurgence and the rebuilding of East St. Louis.
We're talking with Lauren Parks, president of the House of Miles in East St. Louis. The childhood home of Miles Davis is now a museum to the jazz icon, who would have turned 94 years old on May 26th. We're also talking with Dr. Tammy Kernodal, a music professor at Miami University. If you have a favorite tune of Miles, tweet us at 21st Show. Professor Kernodal, Miles Davis music became really popular in the 1950s as African-Americans and the civil rights movement were starting to percolate. Can you describe what he and his music represented to Black people at that time?
I think it embodied the type of radical transgressiveness that we ascribe with the civil rights movement. You know, Miles was never a very open supporter of the movement, but he embodied much of what the movement represented. You know, the resistance to play up to the crowd, his way of envisioning himself as a serious artist, as a composer, as an intellectual, the way that he dressed, all that was a part of, you know, his personification as a Black man, really mirrored what was the rhetoric, the ideology, the progressive politics that fueled the civil rights movement. And so, you know, while we don't oftentimes associate him with the civil rights movement in the way that we associate Nina Simone or Charles Mingus or Thelonious Monk, who actually performed in some of the benefit concerts that helped fuel the direct action campaigns of the South. In many ways, Miles was embodying in a different space because of the way that his music was engaged with by white middle America, in a place of creating a different reading or context of Blackness.
And Professor Kernodal, at Miami University, you teach about Black music, including hip hop and other popular forms of current music. And I wonder if, other than your jazz students, do young people today know who Miles Davis is, and how do they react to his music when you play it?
Yeah, very much they react. I mean, I am oftentimes struck by the students who will come into class and they will have Miles Davis and all these iconic Black musicians on t-shirts or items of clothing. And when you ask them, you know, are you just wearing that for a fashion statement? Oftentimes they will reveal to you that no, there's been a study of the life, there's been a study of the music. And Miles, in many ways, particularly because he kept experimenting and shifting jazz into contexts that aligned it with other forms of popular music, especially from the 1970s on, you know, many of them became connected with Miles through like a Bitches Brew. Or even through, you know, by way of Herbie Hancock, have come into Miles. You know, so there's a different level of engagement and acclimation and introduction to him. So, you know, we talk about Miles in my history of hip hop class because we talk about the level of experimentation he was engaged in the latter part of his life. You know, and the last album that he was working on prior to his death, Doo-Bop. And what did that mean in terms of creating a different instrumental hip hop aesthetic, right? You know, because we only want to center hip hop in the rap aesthetic. So, you know, he's an iconic figure and an iconic musical voice that can be integrated in so many different discussions.
Yeah, you're speaking to me there directly, because Bitches Brew, which is, people aren't familiar, is an album came out in 1970, has a lot of electric elements. That was my first sort of my way into Miles Davis's music. You know, and as we're talking about young people, and we just have, unfortunately, a couple minutes left in our conversation, but Lauren, there at the House of Miles in East St. Louis, part of the goal is to connect young people with the arts. And as I understand it, before the pandemic, at least, the building was a community center of sorts. Can you tell us about some of the activities there?
Yes, we offer numerous educational enrichment opportunities as well as tours, of course, by appointment. We offer the arts. We have a movement with Miles, which incorporates healthy living. That's one aspect of Miles that many may or may not know, that he enjoyed boxing. So we incorporate healthy living with our students as well.
I want to end just with sort of a reflection on Davis's role in each of your lives. Professor Knodel, you're a musicologist, but I understand you were not allowed to listen to jazz in your childhood home. I wonder if you can talk just, again, briefly, we're almost out of time, but when did you first hear Miles Davis, and how did it change your life?
I first heard Miles when I was in college. You know, I grew up in a religious home, and ironically, you know, I listened to a lot of funk and soul, country and gospel, but my father in particular had a disposition against blues and jazz. He saw those as the devil's music and never quite understood that. And I really didn't understand it after I was surprised to find an 8-track tape of Kinda Blue in the basement of my parents' home where they had their record collection. I oftentimes ascribe that to probably my mother and not my father. And I will have to ask her about that one day.
And Lauren, last question to you. Do you have a favorite work by Miles Davis?
Yes. It Never Entered My Mind. That is one of the most soul-stirring songs I've ever heard. So I would say, of course, it's hard to pick a favorite, but that's definitely the top five for me. Let me say that, because, you know, Miles transcends various decades, and so his music evolved. And so from anywhere from It Never Entered My Mind to Doo-Wop, you know, our students love that song, and they love to dance and create dance moves off that song. So I have numerous favorites, but It Never Entered My Mind is definitely in my top five.
Parks is president of the House of Miles in East St. Louis, the childhood home of Miles Davis. You can visit once COVID-19 restrictions are lifted. We were also joined by Miami University musicology professor Tammy Knodel. Both of you, thank you so much for joining us here on the 21st.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That is all the time we have for today. You can find a link to the House of Miles and many of the other things we talked about at our website, 21stshow.org. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to Miles Davis for our theme music today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you.